This is Talk of the Nation. Ray Suarez is away. I'm Melinda Pencava. In the mountains of North Carolina this weekend, a new political party called the Southern Party is kicking off a campaign to make the South a separate nation. The leader of the Southern Party says there's been a cultural bigotry against the South and that Southern culture needs to be preserved, and so this call to secede. Of course, secession was attempted once before and failed, and polls taken over recent years in the South find little support for this idea being revived again. But that this notion of secession persists brings to mind the question, what is it about the South that makes it so very distinct? The Southern Party speaks of preserving a culture, and we would like to know precisely what is the culture of the South? What is the Southern identity? The leader of the Southern Party was not able to be on our show today, but we have asked three other Southerners to join us for this hour to sort through all of this. They are John Shelton Reed, professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina and director of the Institute for Research in Social Science. He is also author of The Enduring South, Whistling Dixie, and 1001 Things Everyone Should Know About the South. John Shelton Reed is a native of Tennessee and joins us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Melinda. Pleasure to be here.
Blanche McCrary Boyd is a novelist and essayist. She is the author of Redneck Way of Knowledge, and she's a professor at Connecticut College. A native of Charleston, South Carolina, Blanche McCrary Boyd joins us from Connecticut Radio Network in Hamden, Connecticut. Welcome to the show, Blanche.
Oh, thanks. It's fun to be here.
And Clifton Talbert is author of Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored and 8 Habits of the Heart. He is a Mississippi native, and Clifton Talbert joins us from KVOO in Tulsa. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you.
And you may join us as well, north, south, east, or west of the Mason-Dixon. We'll take your calls. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Well, we're going to talk about Southern culture and identity, and I'd like to start out with, in what ways is it that the South is still distinct, still different from the rest of the country? And we'll start with you, John Shelton Reed.
Well, it's getting harder to put your finger on it because in some ways we're less different than we have ever been. But I'm persuaded there are some differences worth talking about. They tend to be these days more a matter of style and manners and speech and food and music, sort of intangibles, than any enormous political or economic differences. In particular, we have in this part of the country a sort of Creole culture. It's a biracial, if not more than that, construction that incorporates all sorts of African influences as well as European ones. And that's perfectly evident if you want to talk about food or music mm-hmm. or speech.
Mm-hmm. How about way of life apart from that? I mean, what is it that makes it so different?
Well, there have been some studies that look at things like how fast people conduct bank transactions or whether they help people cross the street if they've got a cast on.
And whether they're hit.
Yeah. Actually, we're no slower than Californians, but we in Californians are slower than other folks in a variety of ways. And we're more helpful than other people. I could prove that now. And we're touchier than other folks. You insult us, we're more likely to hit you. This is the kind of difference we're talking about now. 30 years ago, it was a different story, at least among white Southerners. 50 years ago, you had 98% of white Southerners saying black and white children should go to separate schools. Now that figure is under 5%, and it's no different from what it is anyplace else in the country. So I say some very important regional differences have disappeared in the last 60 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I'd like to explore this hour. So just if we look, say, 30, 50 years ago, how has it changed and how is it still different? So we'll go there. Blanche McCrary Boyd, what's your impression? Now, you grew up in Charleston, but you've been living out of the South for the past few decades. Is that right?
A long time. I like to say that I left the South like it was a burning building. I left when I was 16, and, you know, television had a huge impact on me. When I saw television and saw the Freedom Rides, this was in the late 50s, it was a tremendous awakening that I'd been born on the wrong side of conflict. And the horror about all that. You know, I left until I was 33. When I moved home at the age of 33 for a couple of years and wrote The Redneck Way of Knowledge, my mother's comment was, "We learned a lot while you were gone, didn't we?" And what she meant by that was that, of course, I had come to understand some of what they knew. Southerners have what I like to call narrative intelligence. We have a healthy mistrust of abstraction. There's a worry about being too smart. And if a Southerner wants to answer a question, answer it with a wonderful story that is richer than an abstraction. And if they didn't want to answer the question, they still answer with a wonderful story. And you think they might have answered your question, but you're not sure.
Now, are you saying they don't want to be smart or don't want to appear as though is it somewhat cloaked in a humility?
The way that they're smart is very different. You know, so in my family, our notion of abstraction is to bet on the point spreads on football games or balance a checkbook. You know, you said that we're not that we're like Californians, but I lived in California. And in California, they had to work so hard at relaxing. I mean, they actually had this phrase, "be here now." You know, you tell a Southerner, "be here now," where else would they be? They don't even know what you mean.
1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Clifton Talbert, your impressions on the distinctiveness of the South and Southern culture.
One of the things that I personally feel that growing up in the South, that even in my parents' time, it took cotton and tobacco a long time to grow. And as a result of that, it also gave people this extra amount of time to be narrative in their talks. We weren't totally surrounded by factories and where your time was amassed in rapid time. So in some regards, I say that Southerners from the Carolinas to Alabama to my native state, Mississippi, we do take time. It's not that we weren't filling time, but once you plant the cotton seeds, you have to do something else. So talking and being a person, regardless of your station or status in life, became part of, I think, of what made us different and what continues to define us today.
Mm-hmm. Has that changed in your view? Because it's not, the economy is no longer tobacco and cotton anywhere like it was before. I mean, those are still grown there, but you hear so much about the New South and how it's more urbanized than ever
before. It really is. I think that though we do not have cotton speaking to the world as it once did prior to the 1927 flood, when cotton really made an impact on the world, I think, though, that people today, Southerners, are in some regard still related to that sense of place, that sense of time. But as John Shelton so eloquently said, more of the South today in our differences tend to be intangible differences rather than the things that may have been totally involved in our systems of government and our way of life that we could touch and feel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. This idea of Southern identity, I was an immigrant to the South myself about 15 years ago from Connecticut. It was Southern Connecticut.
And no matter how long you'd have stayed, you'd have still been an immigrant.
Yeah, a Yankee even, yes. but I was not alone, and there have been just boku people who have moved to the South from the North, and I live outside Atlanta now and can tell you there and in other places in the South, there are people who have emigrated from outside of the North from other countries.
Atlanta is not the South any more than Miami is.
Yeah. Blanche, I think I'd,
or Texas.
I think I disagree with you about
that. But you're from North Carolina now. Yeah. Now, you know, I was raised to think they think different in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And I remember a map that had North Carolina skipped on it. It was a book called The Deep South Says Never that came.
Yeah,
it was,
we,
I mean, part of what we're talking about.
But then again, don't forget Mississippi and Alabama, because we pride ourselves as being the Deep South.
Oh, yeah.
And the rest of you are on the fringes of up north.
Well, we're in North Carolina.
We in North Carolina used to be overlooked, you know.
Now, we're very proud of starting the Civil War in Charleston.
But think about Atlanta. You know, people say it's not Southern. People say Chapel Hill's not Southern. But, you know, it's what the South looks like when it's rich and affluent and urban and full of Yankees. I mean, it's just a different South. That's all.
But like Charleston is like Charleston. It's just what it is. It can't be any different. It's like the houses are alive and the people aren't, you know, or the people are more passive than the environment itself. It's like the environment's alive.
Yeah, somebody asked me one time. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
Everybody's being so very Southern here.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things.
Oh, no, you go first.
We do that. But there is one thing to remember, though, in your description when you were telling the world that we were going to talk about our South. It's somewhat ironic that even today, as we broach the new millennium, that we still have reason to talk and discuss this particular geographical area of the American, of our Democratic Republic, mm-hmm. trying still to determine what made it different. Is it still different? And if so, what are the reasons? And I tend to believe that historically there were many people, but we only had, for the most part, one agricultural bag from which to pull our livelihood. Whereas now, the South, the land has freed us to some extent, to an extent that we have invited the commerce of the world into the South. And as part of that trickles in, I think the South itself began to become reflective of a vast sense of being rather than just tunnel into the land and in the produce of the land.
Yeah. You Dixie know, was the land of cotton, and it's not that anymore.
You know, we were talking about narrative intelligence, and I have to tell a little story. I was home visiting, and my mother was going to have her hair set, and she was driving this huge Lincoln. And we pulled into this parking lot. There were no other cars in the parking lot. I mean, no other cars. So she pulled in, and we got out of the car. She was late, and the guy came over and said, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but your car's not straight in the slot. Could you please back it out and repark it?" So she did that, and we got out of the car, and he said, "Ma'am, I'm sorry, and you know, it's not straight, and could you please get back in?" And she did it again, and then the third time we got out of the car, he said, "Ma'am, I'm really sorry." And I said, "Do you think we have nothing better to do than park this car all day?" And later, my mother fussed at me about this. She said, "You know, he was doing the best he could, and you have to get over these New York ways." Now, I think that tells you a lot about the South.
But at the same time...
You are in three different places and nobody's at the same...
Yeah.
John Reed, go ahead.
Somebody asked me one time what I thought the most Southern city was. I thought that was an interesting question. I got to thinking about Charleston, Blanche, and you know, it Lord knows it's Southern, but you know, it's Southern in its own way. As they say in Arkansas, it's sui generis, but that's a Southern joke.
Well, I got it.
it's the same with New Orleans. You know, my candidate wound up being Nashville, because you got everything in Nashville, you know.
And because you're from Tennessee, too, is that right?
Well, Savannah, too. Savannah's good. Yeah.
We'll get back to more in a moment, but you're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue talking about Southern identity. There's a fledgling group that thinks the South is so different that it ought to secede. It's getting that campaign started, and we're talking about Southern culture today. We'll begin taking your calls at 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. At 21 past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava. Today we're talking about the South, what it means to be a Southerner, Southern culture, Southern identity. Our guests this hour are John Shelton Reed, professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Research in Social Science at the University of North Carolina. He is author of, among other things, The Enduring South. Blanche McCrary Boyd is professor of English and writer-in-residence at Connecticut College and author of two novels and a book of essays called The Redneck Way of Knowledge. And Clifton Talbert is lecturer and author of Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored and Eight Habits of the Heart. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number here is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let us go right now to Karen, who is in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi there, Karen.
Hi. First of all, I realized that some Southerners don't consider Kentucky the South, but everybody else seems to, so I thought I'd call in. talking to people from other parts of this, the country and enduring other comments, I'm surprised that the things that people will say about Southerners and the South that I would, you know, comments I would never make to anybody else. And just kind of it's like the last acceptable prejudice or, you know, you can make the most politically incorrect statements about Southerners. And I guess it's more of a comment and a question, maybe why you think this is so. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, thank you for your call, Karen.
Thanks.
Okay, well, let's start with Clifton Talbert. Why do you think that is, what Karen was suggesting there?
Well, I think perhaps it goes back to the fact that as one nation and the succeeding states prior to the Civil War and the southern states haven't lost that, we've never really truly dealt with, I think, everything that Abraham Lincoln invited us to do at Gettysburg in the famous Gettysburg Address. And I think we went on, but we went on without totally re-embracing to the full extent that we should have. And because of that, I think that many people find that the American South is both a place of triumph and tragedy. And on the tragedy side, they tend to maybe speak to that by looking at this one part in our lives that was not so good and not so perfect, but maybe on the other side forgetting that these were our brothers, our cousins, and our friends. And I think that we are still moving toward that type of recognition so that offhanded jokes, be they by a geographical location or a person, would not be accepted, nor would they be even needed.
Mm-hmm. Blanche McCrary Boyd?
Well, I was thinking about the fact, you know, when I was working at the Village Voice and I decided to go home and write Redneck, I went in to see my editor and said, I'm moving back to Charleston. And he said, I could never live in the South. I did voter registration in the 60s. And I said, well, you know, why don't you get in a cab and ride uptown then? In the North, it's very easy, if you're the victor in a war, to think that, in this case, racism is somebody else's problem, and to scapegoat the South. The great advantage of defeat for the white South is to understand that racism is our problem and not someone else's. And in that sense, I think that there's a big advantage over the northern part of the country in terms of just understanding that. But yeah, sure, the South still gets scapegoated for all kinds of things. And also, you know, there's an old saying, the winners write history and the losers write poetry. And the South is such a literary place. And again, that's that narrative thing and that lyrical thing that goes on that can make people think that you're stupid.
John Shelton Reed?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with anything anybody said on this subject, but there's another thing at work, and that is that, you know, the South has been, since 1865 anyway, a very poor region. You know, 60 years ago, South had a per capita income about the same as Mexico's today, and about half of that elsewhere in the country. And Americans, I don't care where they came from, Americans tend to look down on poor folks, and I think partly we got looked down on as being poor, and it was attributed to our laziness and lack of ambition and general shiftlessness. That's changing. That has changed. half the new jobs being created today being created in the South, I wouldn't be surprised to see the stereotype change as well, but it hasn't completely done so yet. Another factor is that we gave them a lot to work with. I mean, we had a whole string of colorful but disreputable politicians that were very much in the news for a very long period. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not like they're making this stuff up out of whole cloth. You know? Mm-hmm.
Bob joins us now in Thomaston, Georgia. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Bob.
Good afternoon. How are you?
All right. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. We're sitting out here on the back porch with the ceiling fan running. I thought that living down here for 44 years, the biggest distinction that I've seen, and I've been all over the country, is that growing up in the South, we were not quite as populated as the northern states, and we had a base population of about 20 to 25% African Americans, and probably about 10% immigrants, be them Cuban or El Salvadorian, Nicaraguan, Colombian, whatever. And we took great pride in kind of adopting everybody into our families. We'd have families come over, and while we were a little more rural than the North, we often would have Thanksgivings with many families together. And because we kind of almost tripped over our politeness and our manners, we took a stance of live and let live. And we may have been a little bit nosy about everybody else in our neighborhood, but that's only because we cared about them. And we had a better communal base. But what I've seen come in through the education system is that the North forced busing on us, and we ended up getting bused sometimes at lunchtime from one school to another just to achieve integration. And I think that in the 1980s and 1990s, I believe that while we're getting batted over the head for integration and of the schools, I believe that most of the people that live here in the towns, they want their children to go to the schools that are within a mile or two of their house, and they don't want to put their kids on school buses for 2 or 3 hours a day. Mm-hmm. But by and large, our motto is live and let live, and we kind of like it that way. We've gotten a lot of people from all over the different states and different countries, and we're feeling a little bit of a pinch. But here in Georgia, we're the largest state east of the Mississippi, and we're the only state that signed off unanimously to the U.S. Constitution in 1787. And because we are such a large state, we're hoping to grow and continue to grow. Mm-hmm. And we're just holding our hand out and telling everybody that's going down to Florida to come on down and stop in Georgia instead.
Well, Bob, thanks for your call. Clifton Tauber, what's your response to what Bob's saying there?
You know, Bob has said a lot, really, because when you make the statement, the Old South, the New South, and then I add another word, the Real South. When I wrote the book Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored, it became an international bestseller and landed all over the world simply because it gave people an opportunity to look into the homes and lives of people who managed to have carved out civility and relationships in spite of legal segregation and all that it had to offer. And I think what Bob is saying, and hopefully I'm reading him correctly, is that within his state of Georgia, as within my home state of Mississippi, there are good people who are trying their very best to do good things within the context of their lives. And if this were not the case, then I don't think we would have the shifting of the economy turning good in the South as perhaps it is, and many people of different ethnicities returning to the South to call it home. True, there are some vestiges of legal segregation that is perhaps more prominent in southern states than they may be in others, but at the same time, I think that cotton taking a long time to grow and being able to cook a pie, rock a baby, shake a hand, and say hello, I am a Southerner, and I feel that is our great export to the nation. I think we have the ability to tell the world that if you take time, stop and take time, you can actually get to know a better person and a better place.
You know, on this issue of race, I wonder, Clifton Talbert, if you feel sometimes when it's described in the media, you know, Southern culture, if folks might be thinking automatically of white Southern culture and not taking into account the black culture that was there right alongside it from the get-go.
Oftentimes, I really feel this because there were really three cultures that happened in the South simultaneously. There was the black culture. When I refer to the Old South, I'm talking about my great-grandfather's home. I'm talking about Papa's house. As far as I'm concerned, I compare it to living in a chateau in Paris. It was the grandest place on the face of the earth for me, not because of what I had, but because of the fact that I was loved, I was wanted, and I had people who cared about me. At the same time, there were white families who could say the same thing, that their great-grandfather was the greatest man on the face of this earth, that their grandmother made the best biscuits that have ever been made. But both of us, unfortunately, had to find a way to live within that third culture that sort of came and meandered between the goodness of our lives and sort of erupted into what we call the Jim Crow lifestyle. That we had to live in front of each other. And for many people, it took a toehold into their lives and perhaps changed the good nature in which they could have had.
Mm-hmm. John Shelton Reed?
You know, when you talk about Southern identity and the Southern way of life and all of these sorts of things, there's been a real change in the last century. If you talked about, you know, what it meant to be Southern 100 years ago, rather plainly, a Southerner was white. It wasn't until the 1960s that black folks in significant numbers began to tell survey researchers, at least, that they thought of themselves as Southerners. You know, before that, you said, are you a Southerner? They said, well, it depends what you mean by that. 1900, you know, to be a Southerner meant to stand up for Dixie, salute the Confederate flag, stand in a particular relationship to the Confederacy. I think that's plainly not over yet, but it's far less important now than it was then. We do surveys here at Chapel Hill, and you know, we've asked people if they have Confederate ancestors, and Southern whites, about one-third tell us they don't know whether they do or not, and another third tell us they know they don't. Mm-hmm. That leaves a third that have ancestors that Confederate, and a good many of them had ancestors on both sides, as in fact I did. You know, 40% of white Southerners tell us they had American Indian ancestors. I mean, mm-hmm. It's easier to find people who are part Indian than part Confederate these days, and that's a change. People talk now about the Southern way of life. They don't mean what Strom Thurmond meant in 1948. He was standing up for white supremacy and segregation, and he wasn't apologetic about it. He didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I mean, that's what he stood for. These days, though, you look at something like the Encyclopedia of Southern Culture that came out of the University of Mississippi. You know, the South that it's describing is this, it has a history, sure, and nobody's denying that. The South, somebody said once, is a region with more than a future. But, you know, the South it's talking about is this South of food and literature and poetry and manners and speech and religion. We haven't talked about religion yet. We can.
You know, I grew up in a, and I assume you did too, John, in a white racist right-wing culture. And at least that's what was going on in the South in the 50s and 60s. And for me, when I went back, I don't find everything quite as changed as y'all seem to. You know, my cousin, Glenn, is a powerful state senator who was on Nightline last Monday night talking about keeping the flag on the state house, the Confederate flag. Listen to me, I'd call it the flag, the Confederate flag on the state house. He spends all of his time, his free time, in these reenactments. And my mother says, you know, if they don't have enough people, sometimes he even plays a Yankee. I mean, that's how they spend their weekends, and it's all about this Southern heritage. Bumper stickers that my family has on their cars say, "Heritage, not hatred, fly it." And it's a picture of the Confederate flag. I don't find, the sentimentalization of Confederate culture, which is, of course, embodied in Gone with the Wind, I don't think that's gone, you know?
Let me just, I just have to interject here for 1 minute and say you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Yeah, Blanche, I wouldn't say it's gone, quite the contrary, but there's been a serious shift in the meaning of it. I mean, the Sons of Confederate Veterans these days are trying to enlist black members, you know, and trying to, and in fact, they're publishing, you know, learned articles on the internet basically arguing that there were a significant number of blacks who fought for the Confederacy. Now, historically, that's a dubious proposition.
It's pretty revisionist,
Yeah, but it's interesting that they feel this is a desirable argument to make, you know, that's
it's like those
change.
Indian ancestors.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing when we, you know, whether we talk about the Confederate flag or those types of symbols that were part of the American South, the fact still remains that human maturity has to take place, and it will always take place in us. And the South, just as any other place, maybe because time moves slowly for us, our maturity has been measured perhaps a little, not quite as fast as it has in other places. But every year for the last 5 years, I've been a lecturer in Natchez, Mississippi, at the Natchez Literary Festival that bring people in from around the country. And though it is not a perfect set of circumstances, but it certainly speaks volumes to the fact that there are a cadre of people who are recognizing that we the people literally means we need to take that and embrace that understanding. And I find that, yes, there are people in the South, American white people in the South, that still embrace everything that may have been historically bad as it related to me as an African American. But I also find that that bedrooms are being opened, that tables are being set, tables are being stretched, and that relationships are being extended in such a way that I don't know that if a party like the Southern Party can really rally the incredible moral support and attention that would be needed to make it a formidable force in the American South.
Clifton Talbert, you're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava. Our guests this hour are John Shelton Reed, Blanche McCrary Boyd, and Clifton Talbert. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we come back, we will talk more about Southern identity and culture, how distinctive it is, and what it means to be a Southerner. We'll take more of your calls at 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. If you'd like to pop us an email, that address is totn@npr.org. At 40 minutes past the hour, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the W. Alton Jones Foundation for coverage of efforts to reduce threats of nuclear war and proliferation, www.wajones.org, Freddie Mac, providing home ownership opportunities all across America, on the web at freddiemac.com, and the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Robert Siegel. 50 years ago, in Montana, 15 young firefighters parachuted into Man Gulch to fight a small ridge fire. Within 10 minutes, the fire had spread over 5 square miles, and within 2 hours, 13 of the firefighters were dead. Later today, we remember what's perhaps the most famous forest fire in America on NPR's All Things Considered.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava. Tune in at this time tomorrow to join Brooke Gladstone on Science Friday as the talk turns to fire ants, an unwanted and unfriendly visitor to our shores. Why are these tropical ants just so happy here and what can be done about them? Plus, why it helps to sleep around if you happen to be the queen ant. Today, we're talking about Southern culture and what makes it distinctive. Our guests are John Shelton Reed, professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Research in Social Science at the University of North Carolina. He is author of The Enduring South and Whistling Dixie. Also with us is Blanche McCrary Boyd, professor of English and writer-in-residence at Connecticut College and author of two novels and a book of essays called The Redneck Way of Knowledge, and Clifton Talbert, who is a lecturer and author of Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored and Eight Habits of the Heart. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number here is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Bob is with us now from Phoenix, Arizona. Hi there, Bob.
Hello. Hello, and thank you for having a program that is so timely. My father was from Paw Creek, North Carolina, which was once outside the city of Charlotte, but is now quite within its boundaries. My mother was from northern Wisconsin, and I have never lived in the South. And to my father's relatives, I was always a Yankee child, and this was, of course, good-natured. But my father never again lived in the South until the later years of his life. He would go back to North Carolina and spend the winters. But he never lost his southernness. He sounded like a southerner. He acted like a southerner, and for me, I always saw myself as part southern, and I considered myself that being raised by a southerner. And in my psychological and emotional landscape, the South was always present as a place, perhaps a mythological place in which I was part. And my father passed down much of the family oral history to me, and it was the way I saw it, very nostalgic for the factory baseball teams and the food and the language and all of those cultural things perhaps that we attach to the South. And I feel a little bit like an orphan child, perhaps, in that I claim the South in my heart, but no one else claims that as well.
Anybody want to take a shot at that? John
Shelton? Could I, Bob?
Sure, go ahead.
You know, one thing that Bob said, that, and I'll be very brief, is that Bob's father has given him something incredible that I've tried to capture in Eight Habits of the Heart. I did 17 lectures in Japan, and I found it amazing. The crowds came out not because I was such a well-known writer, but because I was touted as being a Southern writer, and they had come to hear what this black man had to say about the American South. But there is one thing that Bob has said that I try to say, is the good thing about the South is that it tend to have been more people-centered at one point in time. Though that centering may have happened on opposite sides of the town, now that people are beginning to cross over and talk, I may not have known Bob's father, and we may not have talked as a unit, but today we are given the right to hold a conversation, and invariably we will come up with the same set of ideals, not realizing that even across the street, the power of the land of the South was such that even those families who were oppressed, as it were, and those families who lived around that, they all seemed to have been drawn in to this concept of people centering.
Mm-hmm. John Shelton Reed?
I've got a story sort of like Cliff's. I went to graduate school in New York, and a couple of my best friends up there were two black guys from North Carolina. And in New York, it was perfectly clear that the three of us had some important things in common. This might not have been so clear in North Carolina or Tennessee, but at that time, late 60s in New York, you know, we knew the same Baptist hymns. I'm not a Baptist, and I don't think they were either, but we learned them in school. Mm-hmm. You know, we liked the same obscure vegetables. We had a number of important, it seemed important at the time anyway, things in common, and we just didn't have to explain things to each other all the time. We had a similar sense of humor, like the same music. We all grew up listening to WLAC in Nashville, you know, and there's something almost ethnic about this. I mean, Jonathan Daniels said 60 years ago that, you know, being a Southerner is like being a Jew or a Pole or an Italian. It's an identity, and it carries some cultural freight with it, and it's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is, but you know it when you see it.
Well, Blanche McRae Boyd, do you think that has changed, though, as the South, you get so many more people living here whose, you know, grandparents didn't live in the South, or whose parents didn't live in the South, so many people who came to the region. Is there still that idea of that, you know, if two people who lived in the South, who are first generation, if you will, if they went someplace else, would they have that same kind of kinship, or do you have to have
you have to have been there. I mean, that's just my own experience and feeling that you know, people who lived behind us had been in Charleston for 30 years, and we called them the people from New Jersey. I mean, that's what we did. They undercooked their vegetables. You could tell they were Yankees, you know. And, you know, I am a little bit concerned about, there's a way that I think that we're whitewashing, excuse me about that, but the South a little bit here in terms of how well we're all doing. And yes, I mean, the South that I grew up in is, and the South embodied in Gone with the Wind, is largely destroyed, and thank goodness. And it is important not to throw out certain kinds of things that are really wonderful about Southern culture. This thing I call narrative intelligence, the generosity, the politeness, the eye contact, all of that stuff is so real and wonderful, and the literariness. And I feel like there's a way that by being a little too congratulatory about the South, we're being a little too congratulatory about America and the ways that America is dealing with the problems that were projected onto the South that are really not only national problems, but international problems, world problems, racism. You know, without an evil empire to hold our fragile alliances together, it's not clear to me that, you know, the people in, what do people in Texas and South Carolina have in common with each other? I don't know. I mean, you have militias, you have all this right-wing stuff. What's going to hold us together? And I don't think this notion of the Southern Party is so far-fetched, especially if they can figure out a way to divorce racism, overt racism, from this notion of seceding.
Well, you know, I just received a few emails, and one of them actually gets right to that point. This is from Dominic in St. Louis, who says, as hard as you might try to convince me to the contrary, Southern identity seems inextricably linked to white pride and slavery and Christian-based hate groups. What has been outwardly done to undo this notion?
I think if we look at the political structure in the South today, and when I say the South, I'm speaking to the states that I perhaps paid more close attention to, which would be my home state of Mississippi. I don't know that much about North or South Carolina, or Georgia or Tennessee for that matter. But I see a Mississippi that is decidedly different than the one I knew as a child. As a child, you know, I would be bused and look at the state capitol and at the governor's mansion. As an adult and as a writer, some 30 years later, I'm invited back to Jackson, Mississippi, and I have a breakfast with the governor and his wife. Now, does that happen to everybody on the street? I doubt that very seriously. But at the same time, I see that there are some good things happening, and it's not a fact of congratulating the good over the bad, but we have to recognize that if we do not celebrate the good and recognize its tremendous value to moving us ahead, it leaves a void, and it gives those right-winged groups who may have embraced hatred as their way of life, it tells them that the quietness and the silence is an accolade for them to continue. So when I say that my home state has improved, I really mean that. But I'm not sticking my head in the sand and saying that it does not have a long ways to go. But I want to put on record to those who would try and take that improvement away, I want them to understand that our human life does not have within it the ability to create an immortality of hate.
Let me speak to Dominic's point, if I may. I think empirically he's just wrong about Southern identity being linked to white supremacist attitudes. I mean, for starters, if anything, black Southerners now more likely than white Southerners to tell us that they are Southerners. And, plainly that's not what it means for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what it means to most whites any longer.
I'm thinking that Dominic might be getting at talking about the Southern Party, who I should emphasize we invited to the show, but they couldn't make it because they said they were en route to this inauguration of their secession movement this weekend. I think what he's getting at is maybe that group is saying that it's not racist or white supremacist, but he needs to be disabused of that notion. Then he's not really convinced.
I think people are entitled to be suspicious because time and again, Southern nationalism has been bound up first with slavery, then with segregation. So, I mean, it's quite natural to be suspicious. But rhetorically, at least, they're distancing themselves from that, and that itself is a change of some importance.
Okay. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Christine, who is, she is in Rota, Spain. Hi there, Christine.
Hi. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm from the South. I ended up marrying a Yankee, God forbid, but I'm one of the younger generations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a school that was, I grew up in a school that was half redneck and half black. And what I got out of the experience, and I'm white, is that there really aren't that many differences between a Southern black person and a Southern white person. Whoa, Alec, no. You still there?
Yes, we are there.
Yeah.
Sorry, my son.
Welcome, Alec.
To the phone. But it's kind of like the guy Ryder. My son keeps screaming every time y'all say his name. So
John Shelton Reed or Clifton Talbert?
The black guy.
Okay, Clifton Talbert.
When he was saying about that his grandma's biscuits were the best and all this, and the more I learn about Southern blacks, they seem an awful lot like my family. And to me, Southern is family is of the utmost importance and integrity. Where else can you really go down the street and make a deal on a handshake? You can do that in the South. It is still done. And my meemaw, she can't bake a biscuit worth crap, but I love her greens.
Christine, I think
after my great-grandfather, because he was the best man in the world.
Well, Christine, we're going to end on that note. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank everybody who called and wrote this hour, and thanks especially to our guests. John Shelton Reed is a professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Research in Social Science at the University of North Carolina. He is author of The Enduring South and Whistlin' Dixie. He joined us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thanks for being with us today, John Shelton Reed.
Thank you, Melinda. Enjoyed it.
Blanche McCrary Boyd is professor of English and writer in residence at Connecticut College. She's the author of two novels and a book of essays called The Redneck Way of Knowledge. Blanche McCrary Boyd joined us from the studios of CRN International in Hamden, Connecticut. Thanks again.
Thanks, Melinda, and thanks, John. Thanks, Clifton.
And thank you to Clifton Talbert, who is lecturer on the South and author of Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored and 8 Habits of the Heart. Clifton Talbert joined us from commercial station KVOO in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with all of you today.
Talk of the Nation is produced by Ellen Silva, directed by Arun Rath. Production staff includes Setsuko Sato, Susan Lund, and Devin Robbins. Our intern is Stephanie Purdy. Rich Rary is the technical director with engineering support from Renee Pringle, Suzanne Mesnick, and Gary Henderson. Pete Michaels is executive producer in Washington. I'm Melinda Pencava, NPR News.